Okay, so we're going to pick up the second section on page 158 under the language of responsibility. The language of responsibility. So it says here that besides providing a way to make the content of the message clear or obscure, language reflects the speaker's willingness to take responsibility for his or her feelings, beliefs, or actions. Very important to take responsibility. For your feelings, beliefs, and actions. This acceptance or rejection of responsibility says a great deal about the speaker and it could shape the tone of a relationship. This is definitely one of the keys to a successful, functional relationship, interpersonal relationship. And if we're talking about a romantic interpersonal relationship, one of the true keys to a long-term monogamous relationship that is beneficial to all parties and has the potential for both individuals to develop greater intimacy, then it is true that you must take responsibility for your language. So we'll talk about it statements, I statements, but statements, you and we language and statements on page 158 and 159. It says it statements, and then they list three statements, and they are framed differently. And it says, notice the difference between these sentences. First, it says, it bothers me when you're late. Next, it says, I'm worried when you're late. The next, I next says, it's a bad idea. Or, I don't think that's a good idea. It's a problem, or it's a problem for me. As the name implies, it statements replace the personal pronouns I and me with the less immediate construction, it's. By contrast, I language clearly identifies the speaker as the source of the message. I language clearly identifies the speaker as the source of the message. Communicators who use it statements avoid responsibility for ownership of a message. Instead, attribute it to some unidentified body, the ubiquitous, it somewhere out there. This habit isn't just imprecise, it's an unconscious way of for someone to avoid taking a position. And it says here, such language rarely helps interpersonal relationships, and I will second that. Now we move on to but statements. That would be BUT statements. Statements that take the form X but Y can be quite confusing. A closer look at the but statements explains why. But has the effect of canceling out the preceding thought. And they give three examples. How about I give you this one? This paper has some good ideas, but I'm giving it the grade of D because it's late. So both of those statements on both sides of the comma are true. The paper does have some good ideas, and the grade will be diminished because of its lateness. Buts can be a face-saving strategy worth using at times when the goal is to be absolutely clear. However, the most responsible approach will deliver the central idea without the distractions that come from the word but. Moving on to I, you, and we language on page 159. We've already seen that I language is a way of accepting responsibility for a message. You language is quite different. Like other forms of evaluative language, it expresses a judgment of the other person. Positive judgments, you did a great job, rarely cause problems. But notice how each of the following critical you statements implies that the subject of some complaint is doing something wrong. All right, here's. I'll read these three statements. You left this place a mess. You didn't keep your promise. You're really crude sometimes. It's easy to see why you language can arouse defensiveness. Arouse defensiveness. And you do, as a responsible, competent communicator, you do want to do the best you can to be clear in your communication without arousing defensiveness. That would be a major goal for a competent and ethical, moral communicator. You do the best you can to communicate without arousing defensiveness. It says, and it's easy to see why you language can arouse defensiveness. A you statement implies that the speaker is qualified to judge the target, not an idea that most listeners are willing to accept, even when the evaluation is correct. I language provides a more accurate and less provocative way to express a complaint. I language shows that the speaker takes responsibility for the accusation by describing his or her reaction to the other's behavior without making any judgments about its worth. Communicators who use these kinds of I messages engage in assertiveness, clearly expressing their thoughts, feelings, and wants. So that would be a very positive communicative attribute, assertiveness. Assertive messages are composed of three different I statements. One describes the other person's behavior, one describes your feelings, and one describes the consequences the other's behavior has for you. And it gives a couple of other examples. I'm not going to read them all to you, but let's pick one. Here's a statement. I haven't been very affectionate because you've hardly spent any time with me in the past few weeks. I'm confused about how you feel about me. Let me say it again, since I definitely messed up the reading. I haven't been very affectionate because you've hardly spent any time with me in the past few weeks. I'm confused about how you feel about me. So to break it down, so we have consequences, we have behavior, and we have feelings. So that would be the key, right? So it says here that assertive messages have three components. One, describe the other person's behavior. Okay, so let's see. And this one, describe the other person's behavior. You've hardly spent any time with me in the past few weeks, okay? The next one is describe your feeling. Okay, so let's take a look at that. Oh, I'm confused about how you feel about me, all right? Confuses a feeling. And then that last one describes the consequences for you. That lack of being affectionate is the consequence. So you see how in this assertive message, this I statement broken down into these three components is much more clear, clearer way and a more, I'd say, effective way to communicate. When the chances of being misunderstood or getting a defensive reaction are high, it's good to include all three elements in your assertive message. In some cases, maybe only one or two of them will get the job done, but I think this makes good sense that if there's a chance that the person will react defensively to the message, it's best to use this assertive I approach and have these three components. Describe the other person's behavior, describe your feelings, and then describe the consequences the other's behavior has on you. Okay, moving on to we language. One way to avoid the overuse of the I language is to consider the pronoun we. We language implies that the issue is the concern and responsibility of both the speaker and receiver of the message. And then they have three examples here. I'll read one. We need to talk to your parents about whether we'll visit them for the holidays. It's easy to see how we language could help build a constructive climate. It suggests that we're in this together. Couples who use we language are more satisfied and manage conflict better than those who rely heavily on I or you. Yeah, we is generally very effective, but you could see where you can use it in a sarcastic way. You know, because you could say, we have a problem. But really what you're saying is you're the problem, but you use the idea of we and more sarcastically. So a lot of these ideas are good, but if they are misused or used passive aggressively, then they will backfire. On page 161, there's a table 5.3, an excellent table. It says pronoun uses and their effects. Please look that over. It's actually a really good table. Okay, page 162, evaluative language. Seems to describe something but really announces your speaker's attitude towards it. If you approve of a friend's roundabout approach to a difficult subject, you may call her tactful. If you don't like it, you may accuse her of beating around the bush. Whether the approach is good or bad is a mere a matter of opinion than fact, although the difference is obscured by evaluative language. And they give you a couple of different ways to use language, maybe more effectively. It says, if you approve, say one thing. If you disapprove, say the other. So, thrifty if you approve, cheap if you disapprove. Traditional if you approved, old-fashioned if you disapproved. Information if you approve of it, or propaganda if you don't. You can see how that would work. Okay, so let's talk about on page 162, 163, it talks about gender differences in 164. Given the obvious physical differences between the sexes and the differences in how men and women are regarded in most societies, it's not surprising that the general public has been captivated by the topic of gender differences in language use. Some people believe that men and women communicate in significantly different ways, whereas others find more similarities than differences. I think you could say that there are many more similarities than differences between in gender communication. I think that it's fairly obvious. It's usually about the degree of similarity or the degree of differences where there may be some controversy. They use one example from an author, John Gray, who wrote a book, Men Are From Mars, Women Are From Venus. And that is one way to say that they're miles apart. So gender gender creates differences in the way language is used, and then ultimately the way that language is interpreted, or the way the receivers assign meaning. You can say it that way too. But most researchers will think of John Gray as not as a scientist or a theorist, or someone who has studied interpersonal communication at the research level, but mainly just from personal experience and from narratives of people that he has interviewed. So another approach here, it says, despite the differences in the way men and women speak, the link between sex and language isn't as clear-cut, and even where differences exist, the question is whether they amount to much. So that probably is the big question, that it is true there are differences, and in some specific areas, there may be some significant differences, and maybe other areas, there be a very high level or degree of similarity. So it also can be contextual as well. So minor differences, major differences, and then it says on page 164, accounting for the gender differences. Occupation can trump gender as an influence on speaking style. As an example, male and female athletes communicate in similar ways. Male daycare teachers speak to their students that resemble the way female teachers speak to their students. And they give a couple of different other examples, but in the context of work and vocational communication, you could see there may be some similarity. Another factor that trumps sex differences is power. For instance, in other kinds of relationships, biological sex may not be as important. It says here, there are also a few differences between the way men and women use powerful speech. They say specifically threats, when they have the same amount of bargaining strength in a negotiation. So when the men and women are peers, where they have a similar bargaining strength, then they communicate, you know, similarly. Findings like this suggest that characteristically feminine speech has been less a function of gender or sex than of a woman's historically less powerful positions in some parts of the world. Okay, moving on, it says on page 164 and 165, social media and language. And it says, the principles described so far in the chapter apply to language in face-to-face interactions as well as mediated communication. However, research has begun to discover some unique dimensions of language as it's used in social media. All right, so we have online language and impression management, and then we have online and gender. and that will bring the chapter to an end. It says, as we've noted in chapter 3, hopefully you have read chapter 3, because interpersonal communication itself is kind of the baseline for a lot of the chapters that precede that. Much of chapter 3 on online communication and an exercise, they've noted that in chapter 3, much of online communication is an exercise in impression management. We've also talked about that. For example, text message errors can make the sender look bad to some recipients. So it's important to manage those impressions. One way to do so is by using a block signature indicating that a text message was typed on a mobile device. Some texter signatures point blank say, "This was written on my cell phone, so please excuse the unlikely errors." This, in essence, shifts the blame for the mistakes from the message to this, from the message sender to the device that's used. So I sent this while I was texting, driving the car, while eating an In-N-Out burger. So if anything here is misspelled or maybe the tone is not acceptable, please excuse the fact that my double-double is dripping in my lap. Something like that. Moving on, it says, dating websites are all about impression management. Subscribers to online dating services not only can manipulate their photos and videos, but also their verbal self-descriptions. One study found that less attractive participants make more linguistic and numeric embellishments than attractive candidates do. Women are more likely to lie about their weight on dating sites, whereas men misrepresent their professions and income. On a less intentional level, even a person's first name creates an online impression. A German study found that men named Alexander were 100% more likely to get visits on a dating site than those named Kevin. Yeah, I don't know why, but there is a cultural issue here between Germany and the United States. Page 166, impression management isn't restricted to a search for romantic partners. Facebook friends also try to put their best foot forward with strategic language choices. They use more positive emotion words in their public updates, projecting an upbeat persona. In private messages, Facebook people are more willing to let their guard down and share negative feelings. And then the last section here is online language and gender. Research shows that men and women have different written language styles, which shows up in online communication. For instance, men tend to use more large words, nouns, and swear words than women do. On the other hand, women use more personal pronouns, verbs, and hedge phrases. Of course, word count doesn't tell the story. For instance, whereas women and men use the words we about equality, they do so in different ways. Closer scrutiny suggests that women are more likely to use what's known as the warm we. That's a weird saying, warm we. We have so much fun together, and men are more inclined toward the distance we. We need to do something about this. It's also worth noting that computers aren't foolproof. They can correctly identify the sex of an author about 72% of the time. In other words, although there are indeed gender tendencies in language usage, they're not absolute. Well, they just said that 72% of the time they can tell. So that is interesting that the computer, the language that we use, is gendered, and people could tell the difference. Online language differences between sexes are much more pronounced amongst adolescents. A study looked at the word choices of teenage boys and girls in chat rooms. The boys were more active and assertive, initiating interaction and making proposals, whereas the girls were more reactive. The boys were also more flirtatious and sexual than the girls. Okay. All right, so that's page 167. That brings this chapter to an end. Two parts. Approximately 55 minutes or so, 50 minutes for both of those sections. Okay, so this is Professor Tufano. I am out.